Now we're going to shift gears a little bit, and as I mentioned before, I wanted to take a slightly broader look at some of the other implications of this relatively new clinical entity of adrenal incidentaloma. And with that, I'm going to introduce Dr. Tracy Wang, who is a professor of surgery at the Medical College of Wisconsin, Milwaukee, well-known in the endocrine surgery world, but has also taught us so much about the fields of cost-effectiveness and also some of the public health implications. So I'm going to turn it over to Dr. Wang.
Thanks, Dr. Shen. So in the next maybe 15, 20 minutes or so, I'm going to take you through my approach to how I thought about this talk. It's got a little bit less data than perhaps Dr. Grubbs and Lee's talk, and you'll kind of see why in a few minutes. So I have no disclosures, and really the objectives of this talk are we've already gone through what is an adrenal incidentaloma and what are the critical questions associated with it from Dr. Grubbs and Dr. Lee's talk, and I want to take a slightly different look at these same questions. So what are the implications of these questions and recommendations from a cost standpoint and also from a quality of life standpoint for patients? So an adrenal incidentaloma, as we've heard, is an asymptomatic adrenal mass, lesion, depending on how you want to talk about it, that's detected on imaging, not performed for suspected adrenal disease. And so what do we need to know? We need to know about hormonal activity, radiographic characteristics and our risk of malignancy, indications for surgery, and if we're not going to operate, what sort of surveillance do they need? And so what are the associated questions that I think get to the public health and costs implications of this? So what are the implications of untreated hypertension, diabetes, and osteoporosis, perhaps related if we don't diagnose a functional tumor? How do we balance the risks of repeat imaging, and Dr. Lee mentioned some of the data on exposure to radiation, versus identifying clinically relevant disease? What are the risks and benefits of surgery, potential complications of surgery, versus surveillance of an adrenal mass lesion, now I don't know what to call it. And what are the costs of surveillance, and what do those costs include? Well, they include more than just the dollars that we put towards getting a CT scan or an MRI, right? So there's the financial cost, both direct, like how much does a test cost, but also the indirect. So when we ask our patients to do the 1 milligram DEXA suppression test, you know, can they do that with their work schedule? What do they need to do to get to the lab in the morning? Do they need to take the bus? Can they drive? Does that delay them going to work and days off from work? What if we miss an adrenal cortical cancer? What if we miss a functional tumor and they have worsening comorbidities? And what is that risk of additional radiation from imaging studies if we're getting a CT scan every 5 years? And maybe they get CT scans for other body parts, and this all adds up cumulatively, and I don't know that we have the good answers for that. So if we look at functional adrenal tumors, and so I'm going to try to lay out an argument here, if you'll let me. So what are the typical comorbidities that we've just heard about? Hypertension, diabetes, osteoporosis and the risk of fractures, obesity, and then other / quality of life. So the neurocognitive symptoms that may accompany things like a pheochromocytoma or particularly cortisol excess. And so if we look at these four conditions, hypercortisolism, so overt Cushing's, dysregulated hypercortisolism, also called subclinical, also called possible autonomous cortisol secretion, a pheochromocytoma, and primary aldosteronism. So how are these related to these comorbidities? Well, pretty clearly we know that cortisol excess, whether it be mild or overt, can be related to all five of these that I'm going to talk about. If you have a pheochromocytoma, perhaps more related to hypertension and quality of life issues, and certain for primary aldosteronism, also hypertension. And there are some quality of life issues. If you have to take 180 milliequivalents of potassium a day or you feel terrible, that's a pretty significant impact on patient quality of life. So let's look at these public health from a public health perspective. So 75 million American adults, so 32% of our population has hypertension. Only 54% really have it under control, and then 1 in 3 American adults may have pre-hypertension. And high blood pressure costs the U.S. about almost $50 billion a year. If we look at diabetes, 30 million American adults have diabetes. About a quarter of them might not even know it, either because they're not seeing their provider or they're not compliant. It's the 7th leading cause of death in the United States and the number one cause of kidney failure, lower limb amputations, and adult onset blindness. And 84.1 million adults, so more than one third, have prediabetes. And this is all CDC information. And then if we look at osteoporosis, 25% of women over the age of 65 and 5% of men over the age of 65 have osteoporosis. And over 300,000 people each greater than 65 are hospitalized for hip fractures each year. And what about obesity? So this is for data that's a couple years old, but 93 million Americans will be considered to have obesity. The estimated annual cost of that is $147 billion, and if you look at 2008 U.S. dollars. And the medical cost for people who have obesity is, you know, and this is kind of all, this is just a societal cost, so it's not strictly $1,400, but $1,400 higher than those of normal weight. And if you look at this map, in 2017, every single state in the United States had more than 20% of the population of adults who are considered to have obesity. So you could argue that there's a lot of public health costs associated with the comorbidities that we can see with functional adrenal tumors. So getting to CT scans, an estimated 81 million abdominal CT scans were performed in 2014 in the United States. And this doesn't include how you might find adrenal incidentalomas for MRIs, PET scans, ultrasounds, other things. And as we've heard, the prevalence is maybe, you know, around 4 to 5%, but it varies and increases with age. And the recommendations regarding the extent of initial evaluation, as we've heard, sort of look at how often we need to image them, and then what do we need to do from a biochemical evaluation standpoint. So if we look at the imaging standpoint, in 2010, the American College of Radiology published a white paper that looked at how they recommend following various abdominal incidentalomas. So this included pancreatic lesions and adrenal lesions and everything like that. And that kind of spawned a set of data primarily in the endocrine and radiology literature, looking at what is the risk of malignancy and how often do we need to do these imaging studies. And so these are a few papers that that I read in preparation for this talk, and basically a lot of them said you don't really need to do additional imaging. The risk of malignancy is going to be really low, and maybe we're just we're overcalling everything and we're getting too much imaging from this. In 2017, the ACR published a white paper purely looking at the management of adrenal masses based on that 2010 paper and some of the subsequent literature that had been published. And so this was their algorithm. So the yellow are sort of clinical evaluation points. The green is sort of clinical decision-making points, and I know this font is small. And the red are sort of management sort of hard stops. And I put this up there not so much so you can read all the fine print, but to talk about a few key points from this white paper. So some changes that they mentioned from the 2010 algorithm that they published was that they recommend consideration of biochemical evaluation for incidental adrenal masses, recognizing that there is not substantial literature to support this practice. And when they said that, I think they referred to what Dr. Grubbs showed you as the different guidelines from the different societies and what Dr. Lee showed you. And they actually, the ACR, if you read this paper, make a really strong argument that there's a lot of controversy and nobody agrees, and so you shouldn't kind of get biochemical evaluation, which I think we might actually quibble with that interpretation. But they do mention biochemical evaluation, and so all those little asterisks are areas where they say you can consider a biochemical evaluation for a functional tumor. And again, so they go through this whole lengthy 2 or 3 paragraphs about overdiagnosis, and I'm just going to highlight this part, where they say, in the setting of benign incidental findings, the concept of non-reporting has been introduced but remains controversial. Because of the high prevalence of benign incidental adrenal masses, we strongly, and this is the American College of Radiology, we strongly encourage radiologists to consider risks for overdiagnosis when managing affected patients. I think this is reasonable. I think it highlights how if you don't look at your own study, you're not going to know if they're not reporting something. But I think it's also, and because we're at the American College of Surgeons, I think I can say this, I think we have to be a little bit careful when our radiology colleagues are potentially managing patients without that clinical context. And so I think that's really important when we think about the potential implications of adrenal incidentalomas. So if we take it from that standpoint, not looking at it from a purely imaging standpoint, but trying to also say, what is the clinical context that we're looking at? Then I think we have to look at some of the endocrinology and endocrine surgery guidelines. And that gets to the NIH State of the Science Statement, which is now 15, 16 years old. The American Association of Clinical Endocrinologists and American Association of Endocrine Surgeons guidelines that both Dr. Grubbs and Dr. Lee talked about, as well as the more recent European data from the European Society and NSAP. So these are the European guidelines that were published that Dr. Lee mentioned, and I bring this algorithm to highlight that they really talk about what I feel is a more appropriate way of looking at this and assessing everything in parallel, the risks of malignancy and the likelihood that you have a functional tumor, right? Is it going to be functionally active? And then to discuss it in a multidisciplinary team, which I think brings us back into the clinical context and what are really the potential health implications and the cost implications if we're looking not only at the risk of malignancy from a purely objective imaging standpoint, but from the patient, from the perspective of an individual patient and their comorbidities. And so this was an algorithm that they talked about for autonomous cortisol secretion. And I highlight this because, as we've heard from our previous two speakers, they have a much more conservative approach in terms of the amount of, and frequency of testing. And in this, if you look at the first row, comorbidities potentially related to autonomous cortisol secretion. And so they really, when they get to the next line, which is considered surgical removal, they really take a conservative approach to recommendations for adrenalectomy. I quibble with this a little bit because if we think about public health and the data that I just showed you in the United States, what are the comorbidities potentially related to autonomous cortisol secretion? Hypertension, glucose intolerance, obesity, dyslipidemia, and osteoporosis. And this is actually from, this table is from the European guidelines, and I think it really closely mimics what I just showed you of the prevalence of a lot of these in the United States is extraordinarily high. And I am not by any means trying to make the argument that we need to start screening all of our hypertensive obese patients for Cushing's, because that will just, that's definitely going to be like overkill. But I do think we have to think about what our population is, what comorbidities do our population have, and can we make the same argument for the European data that we can for the in the United States. And so this is the rates of obesity. So I showed you the map of the United States on the right, where there's not a single state that doesn't have at least 20% of our adults with obesity. And then this is a map that I found of the European Union. And so I know it's somewhat small, but you can see, and actually my geography is terrible, I don't know what country that is, but it's got a 32% rate of obesity. Almost all the other nations are about 20%. So that's very, very different than the profile we're looking at the United States. And so I might make the argument that if we're looking at comorbidities and potential autonomous cortisol secretion, as particularly if we're looking at it as subclinical or mild level, some of the European data, maybe it's not applicable to us in the United States. So a couple years ago, I worked with some of my mentors to look at a cost-effectiveness analysis. So Dr. Lee mentioned that we have a lot of data with small sample sizes, and so we try to extrapolate that by doing some larger hypothetical, theoretical analyses to look at cost-effectiveness analysis. And so what we looked at was just resection of non-functional adrenal incidentalomas. And what we did was a decision analysis model with a patient who was 40 years old with a 4-centimeter non-functional adrenal incidentaloma. And we looked at whether or not we performed surgery laparoscopically, whether the patient had surveillance, or where they just didn't have any additional follow-up. And this was the diagram that we used to sort of show our analysis model and what happened if they had benign versus malignant disease. And to walk through sort of a cost-effectiveness analysis, you're looking at cost on the y-axis and the quality adjusted life years on the x-axis. And that diagonal line is sort of the societal willingness to pay for a modality, whether it be surgery or surveillance. And so you don't want to be somewhere where you have high costs and low quality adjusted life years. You kind of want to be where something is less expensive or less costly and have high quality of life. And so depending on that willingness to pay, it depends on where that threshold lies, and it's going to be a little bit different for everybody. But when we looked at our data, what our data suggested was that surgery was more cost effective than either surveillance or just not following up. But if you weren't going to do surgery, then perhaps you should consider surveillance. So this gets to some of the data that Dr. Grubbs and Dr. Lee mentioned. And what are the things that affected the cost analysis from the societal perspective, so not from an individual perspective, is the likelihood of having adrenal cortical cancer, the likelihood that you would survive from having adrenal cortical cancer. People who had perhaps smaller tumors, it's not going to be as cost effective to do surgery. And at a certain age, you might also say at some point surgery might not be effective because we know they are not going to develop a malignancy. There may be other comorbidities and surveillance may be appropriate. And so we concluded that compared to surveillance and sign-off, surgery for non-functional adrenal tumors that were about 4 centimeters or larger, and perhaps in certain select patients even smaller than 4 centimeters, would be cost-effective. There's a lot of limitations to that study because we don't have a lot of data on the natural history and subtleties of diagnosis of mild cortisol excess that would have affected some of the data that we put into our model. So more recently, the San Francisco group looked at the cost-effectiveness analysis of surveillance strategies for small, non-functional, benign adrenal incidentalomas. And so this gets to some of the conflicting data from the American guidelines from almost 10 years ago and then the more recent European data. So this was a decision analysis model of surveillance strategies for incidental adrenal tumors. Again, they used a 40-year-old patient with a 4-centimeter tumor. That initial evaluation was non-functional and that appeared benign with less than 10 Hounsfield units on CT scan. And so the strategies that they incorporated were then to do no further workup, to do a one-time evaluation, to do it annually for 2 years or annually for 5 years. And so this was the model that they utilized in terms of their decision making. The costs they used were from 2016 Medicare reimbursement, adjusted for the consumer price index, and they considered a laparoscopic adrenalectomy in their costs as opposed to open adrenalectomy. And again, their effectiveness was measured in quality adjusted life years, which I referenced earlier. So one fully healthy life year is one quali, and death is zero qualis. And they used quality values for 1 year living with surveillance, the utility of life after surgery for malignant disease, and then the utility for 1 year living with a long-term operative complication, right? Because surgery, as low risk as we'd like to think it is, it's never without any risk. And they also, interestingly, used an incremental decline for each CT scan performed. And I think that gets to some of the unknown data that we have about the risks of radiation if you have multiple CT scans. And so their initial results for that base case 40-year-old patient, if you look on the graph and the figure, essentially show some of the same data. But if you have no surveillance or one-time surveillance appeared to be the most cost-effective strategy, followed by no surveillance. But then if you got annually for 2 years or annually for 5 years, you can see we sort of fall into that quadrant where we didn't think it was really cost effective at all. When they did a sensitivity analysis, so they ranged their data input to see what would most affect the model. Again, the prevalence of adrenocortical cancer was most obviously had the most effect on whether or not you did surveillance or not. And then they looked at this by age. So again, you can see here that if the younger the patient is, as opposed to an older patient, the more cost-effective the idea of having some no surveillance or even some surveillance is, and you can see those rainbow-colored lines following that thought process. So their findings were that one-time follow-up imaging and biochemical evaluation is cost-effective, particularly in patients less than 60 years. It's a little bit less stringent than that recommended by the AAES guidelines and closer to the recommendations by the European data. Again, the model was largely dependent on the prevalence of adrenocortical cancer, which we know is rare. And similarly, these cost-effectiveness models, they're only models and they're hypotheticals. So the data that you put in is significantly going to affect your output, particularly with subclinical hypercortisolism. I think the problem with that is that we just don't have actually a lot of really good data about the natural history. So we have these smaller cohorts that Dr. Lee mentioned, and as we follow them out for 5, 10, 15, 20 years, I think we'll have better a better idea of what the optimal approach was going to be. So the conclusion of these past 15, 20 minutes or so is that there's an continued increase in the identification of incidental adrenal tumors on imaging studies. I think we have to balance the costs of surveillance, secondary to the risk of a primary adrenal malignancy or a functional tumor, with the costs of a malignancy or worsening comorbidities. And yes, a standardized approach is certainly going to be desirable and make a lot of clinicians' and patients' lives a lot easier. The issues are, do we have a healthcare system that has the capacity for the associated costs of testing, right? The financial costs, the societal costs, the risk of radiation, the manpower to manage all of this. And I would argue right now, I don't think we do. And so I think this affects how we look at this from a public health perspective. Are there differences between the European and the US studies and patients that would guide management differences? So the rates of hypertension, diabetes, osteoporosis, obesity, and the relationship to adrenal function, are they different in our populations? And I think that there's still so much unknown about the true natural history of adrenal incidentalomas. So there are a lot of potential public health implications, both from a quality in life, quality of life, and a cost perspective. I think we need to continue to look at our patient populations in larger studies to really know what the true implications are, what the true rates of all of these comorbidities are related to adrenal function, and that will help guide us in the future. So there's a lot of risk to overdiagnosis and overtesting, and I don't think we have enough information to know how to balance that for these incidental adrenal tumors. So I'll leave you with that little cartoon. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wang, and thank you to the panelists for their enlightening talks, stimulating, I think, for us, a lot of different thoughts about how to both work up and manage these patients, but also where they kind of fit in the current healthcare environment. Now, I wanted to first open the floor up for any questions, cases, issues that any of you want to bring up. But if not, I'm going to try to challenge these guys. Actually, Dr. Drake, one of our local endocrine surgeons here at BU. No mic? Yeah? Or can we get microphone for audience, please? Yeah.
I think it's working. So great talks. You guys are all surgeons that I look up to and hope to emulate. Where I work, we're looking at this issue from a systems perspective, sort of. And this is being discussed in the literature, and I think sort of how patients get from detection, right? This isn't a diagnosis so much as it's a detected finding, to an appropriate evaluation and then to treatment. And that has really fallen in a large part on the primary care providers in a lot of our health systems. And we've been doing some interesting surveys and discussions and focus groups with the PCPs. And it's really interesting to hear their perspective on how to work these up and the confusion of all the different guidelines and stuff. And so we're hoping to learn more about that. What specific things come up in terms of the evaluation, I wonder what you guys think about this. Our endocrinologists feel that if a adrenal lesion meets criteria for a cortical adenoma, which by definition should not be a pheochromocytoma since that's a medullary tumor, they prefer not to send or do a screening test for pheo. And that's actually pretty consistent with the 2016 European guidelines, which makes mention of not doing that. And I wonder if you guys would mind commenting on that. When patients get referred to me for straight to me for an incidentaloma, I tend to do that study. But our endocrinologists do not. They're concerned about the high false positive rate of the screening test. And so I wonder if you guys would comment on that.
I would agree with you that we do evaluate for either plasma adenephrines or fractionated urinary. I think that especially if you have a lesion that you're able to not go and do more advanced imaging for, right? You don't have to do the triphasic, then I would put the effort in doing the complete functional workup. We've had the discussion about urinary versus plasma. As soon as you think that urinary is the right thing to do because the false positive rate is lower, you have the patient, you get the run of patients that just couldn't do the complete test. That really is a patient population issue in determining, what is appropriate for your patient to do. But I don't think we are, I don't think that, I'm certainly not wise enough, and our endocrinologist will say this as well, to be able to make the determination on an incidentaloma that they do not need to test for the medullary function. Because when you look at the studies, a lot of patients with pheos, they're going to be asymptomatic still. They're not coming in with hypertension, headaches, sweating, all of these things. So I would lean more towards doing a complete functional workup.
We do as well. I don't know our endocrinologists feel as strongly as yours do. I think anecdotally, we've also talked about that the alleged false positives of plasma metanephrines if you're not, you know, supine and all, you know, seated and doing all that stuff and resting for 20 minutes is a lot. We talk about it a lot, but in reality, I don't think you get that such false so many false positives into such a degree that you really then suspect that these patients have a FEO. So we'll routinely get them.
Yeah, no, absolutely agree. We do metanephrines on those patients routinely. You know, when you think about the risk benefit analysis that a surgeon does versus an endocrinologist, you know, we're sort of at the other end of the spear. So if we would rather accept a false positive on that test for someone we know who's going to an operation, because you know, at the end of the day, if they're normotensive, you know, maybe you put them on a little bit of a calcium channel blocker for a week or two, and that's a pretty benign intervention. But the potential downside can be catastrophic if you miss a FEO. So, you know, we routinely test them all.
And I think the other thing that I always have to remind myself is when you're talking about an incidentaloma and you're getting plasma metanephrines, they're going to be four times normal. You're not looking at something that's red and then you look at it and it's 0.2 over, right? That's important when you have concern for hereditary disease, when you're finding a FEO at a young stage and, you know, when we're talking about screening, that's when it's important. But when you're talking about just screening for an incidentaloma, it should be four times normal. And that's the thing to kind of remember when you're looking at these values.
I have a question at the rear microphone. May we have a rear mic on, please? Nope. Still. Mm-hmm. Maybe come up. Yeah, come up forward.
We can all come to the front. We, first row.
We pick the largest room in the entire venue.
It feels like we're at Fenway with that reverb.
Thanks.
Well, thank you, the panel. My name is Zia Bagmanli. I'm a general surgeon at Red Bud, Illinois. I have a case question for the panel. What would you do in a otherwise asymptomatic 25-year-old female who had an imaging study for another unknown reason and shows a completely cystic right adrenal mass measuring 10.7 centimeters in size. Mm-hmm. As I said, patient's completely asymptomatic provided the hormonal workup is negative. Would you consider surgery, follow-up, or maybe even aspiration, anything like that? Thank you.
Who wants to tackle this of the panel? 10 centimeter cyst, asymptomatic, young patient.
Yeah, so I think you can do nothing for that. You can aspirate it. It will probably come back, and so you'll be in that same position. I think the biggest thing here is the patient's age. If she's 25 and she has the desire to become pregnant at any point in her future years, that might be the issue with how you manage a 11 centimeter cyst. Are there increased risks potentially of rupture when she, with a gravid uterus and all of that? So that becomes part of the, I think, the discussion. And so you might consider a laparoscopic adrenalectomy for that. And I think we've done one or two really big cysts in the past few years. And what we will often do is once we're there, we'll drain a little bit of it so we're able to grasp it a little bit more easily. Otherwise, you're just going to potentially rupture it and it's going to be more difficult operation. So if you can kind of puncture it, drain some of the fluid, but not all of it, that kind of helps from a technical standpoint.
Yes, I mean, I think this gets back to the whole recommendation that, number one, decisions made in a multidisciplinary environment, but also, you know, a discussion with a patient. So, you know, some patients will tell you very clearly, there's something there, shouldn't be there, 99.9% benign, not going to cause a problem. You know, I still don't like it, I want it out. So, I mean, I think every patient comes to your office with a preconceived set of notions that you have to take into account. Having said that, we tend to leave these alone. If there's no evidence of mass effect, we tend to leave those alone if they look like a classic simple cyst.
Another local endocrine surgeon, Dr. Nays.
Thanks to everyone on the panel for really an outstanding set of presentations. I'm interested to get your opinion on what we do postoperatively. What do you do postoperatively for functional masses, specifically for aldosteronomas and for adrenal Cushing's lesions. For example, some of my patients with aldosteronomas are on 5 medications, and presumably they have simultaneous primary hypertension in addition to primary hyperaldosteronism. So I'm never quite sure how many meds should I send them home with, and I'm interested to get your opinion on that. Second, for adrenal Cushing's lesions, specifically those with subclinical or even overt Cushing syndrome due to an adrenal lesion, who do you give prophylactic hydrocortisone to, anticipating that they'll be adrenally insufficient from contralateral suppression?
So maybe I'll take that. So for the hyperaldosteronism patients, in general, stop all potassium. If, as long as you feel confident that you've done the right thing, you stop all potassium supplementation. You stop all mineralocorticoid receptor antagonists. Stop any antihypertensives that may increase the potassium levels. And then typically after that, I either, if they are severely hypertensive preoperatively, I'll cut the rest of their medications in half and have them see their primary care doc or whoever's managing their medications within the week. If they're on a beta blocker, I typically keep them on a beta blocker or at least cut it to half dose. I think it's very important to get an aldosterone and a potassium on postoperative day one. You know, if your aldosterone levels are suppressed at that point, then you know there's a very high likelihood that you've cured that patient. If your potassium, if your aldosterone is still a little bit elevated, or your potassium is low, then you know you may rethink how you manage their antihypertensive postoperatively. For the Cushing's patients, we actually use the Professor Shen steroid taper for all those patients, and you know we err on the side of a steroid taper for patients with subclinical Cushing's, or, you know, what we used to call subclinical Cushing's.
So, yeah, with the primary aldosteronism, I agree. And I think some of it depends on the patient's history. If they're, you know, some of the older patients who have had longstanding hypertension that then just got worse when they developed that primary aldo, I'm a little bit more conservative about cutting back on their antihypertensives because they're probably still going to need something in the long term. From a cortisol excess standpoint, we manage patients very differently, and we started this about 5-6 years ago with our endocrinologist. So if they're having a unilateral adrenalectomy with relatively mild and sometimes even overt cortisol excess, we do not give routine glucocorticoids. So we don't give it perioperatively at the time of surgery, and we do a post-op day one cosentropin stim test, which is the data we presented at the AES several years ago. So based on that cosentropin stim test, we will then decide if our patients need to go home on glucocorticoid replacement. And about half of our patients did not, and they all did fine. And you know, more recently, I've probably been a little bit more aggressive, and even some of our patients who are a little bit more overtly Cushingoid, I do that post-op day one cosentropin stim test. And most of them end up needing glucocorticoids. I think it helps us guide in discussion with our endocrinologist how much to send them home on. But I think one of the salient points to me was that in that first 12-hour post-op period, you know, none of them developed, you know, florid adrenal insufficiency or anything. So it was kind of safe to wait, but we are a little bit more conservative with the post-operative steroids.
So we fall to that side as well. We do cosentropin stim test. The thing to remember there is that it's not the easiest test to do. It's not a test that the floors and the nurses do often, and it's super easy to screw up. So if we're at all concerned, instead of keeping them in the hospital for another day to give it another try, we'll try to do the cosentropin stim. If it's done correctly, wonderful. If not, we err on the side of then saying we're not going to keep you longer. We're going to move forward with putting you on steroids. I think the other thing to remember with this, for both your trainees and for the patients, is even if you send them out on steroids, or certainly if you don't, it's going to be the education of what adrenal insufficiency can look like, and having them be so conservative about just call if there are issues or go to the emergency room. So they have to be educated in this setting, and the trainees as well, you know, to understand what these things can mean in these what AI can mean in these patients. The other thing is for the aldosterone is just the managing expectations for patients. You're going to be on antihypertensives. Studies just show we don't get you off of all of your antihypertensives. And the one thing to note, if we're, you know, checking for that, what I didn't say in my talk if you're going to do things like testing aldosterone afterwards, which we do as well sometimes, you know, a lot of times these guys are going to be on spironolactone and eplerenone coming in right before these surgeries, understanding that how that can modify your, you know, your test, and if they're on these things preoperatively to be able to use that when you're making your interpretations of the test.
Well, I want to thank the audience for sticking around for this really, really wonderful session, and also to the panelists. Thanks very much.
Thanks.